This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 54. And very excited about this one. Today, we're going to be in conversation with Mark Green, who is the senior editor of the Good Men Project and the founder of Remaking Manhood. And we're going to talk about his recent article that's got a lot of traction, titled Dear APA, I Love You, But the Problem Isn't Traditional Masculinity. And we're also, Mark has a new book out, The Little Me Too Book for Men, that I think everybody should be taking on. And I know we get a lot of therapists, psychologists, social workers listening to this and just, you know, all kinds of other folks. So it just, I think it's, if you're working with men, et cetera, you should absolutely pick this stuff up. But we're going to break down the APA's individualizing perspective and on their recent announcement about traditional masculinity. And we're going to talk about man box culture and the growing anxiety of men. Men's rights group, who I've gotten a lot of slack from in the past. Men's silence and how men might be more courageous and relational. It's wonderful conversation, and I'm glad you're here for it. But before we get there, a couple of quick announcements. Lynn Rosen, who many of you might remember from a couple of episodes past where we talked about embodying conversations and how she integrates EMDR and somatic therapies with narrative therapy. Well, Lynn is going to be doing two things, a consultation group and also a 12-hour training that starts, I think, February 7th. And so if this is of interest to you, this is a great opportunity to work closely with Lynn. So you could do that. You just go to reauthoringteaching.com, and you can get all the information about the consultation group and also the 12-hour training with Lynn. And it'll all be covering what she talked about in our episode, Embodying Conversations. It'll be working around integrating EMDR and somatic practices with narrative therapy. So so you might want to jump on that. Great opportunity to work closely with Lynn. And another announcement, I don't know if you are all active on tctv.live. If not, you should check it out, tctv.live. All things narrative therapy. The reason I'm bringing it up is that on February 28th, Stephen, in through that website, does a lot of live interviews with various practitioners all over the world. So it's really rich learning opportunities, right? And so, but my wonderful colleague, Justine D'Arrigo-Patrick, and myself are going to be doing a live kind of presentation interview thing on February 28th on 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, February 28th. And our talk is titled Beyond Deconstruction, Post-Structuralist Social Justice. So if you want to find out what that's all about, go check out tctv.live. And on February 28th, come visit us, join us in that conversation. And there's a lot of other great talks, interviews lined up, live stuff. Jeff Zimmerman's on the schedule. Todd May talking about Foucault's on the schedule. Tom Strong, who I really have enjoyed when I've seen him present, is going to be talking about the power and politic of the DSM. So a lot of great stuff. You should check it out, tctv.live, if you haven't already. And think about joining us on February 28th. And I'll have other announcements coming up. I'm going to be at a couple of conferences coming up, one of them being the Therapeutic Conversations Conference in Vancouver. Justine and I will be doing a more expanded version of what we're going to be doing on the 28th. And then at the AFTA conference, I'll be a participant, a plenary speaker in Oakland in June. And I'm probably going to try and get some radical therapist get-togethers like we did in San Diego last year, and that was so much fun. And so if you think you're going to be in Vancouver in May or in Oakland in June, reach out to me because I want to try to pull something together. So think about that, please. And real quick, find us on social media. Those of you that might not be, you know, familiar with us yet, or you're a new listener or what have you, this Radical Therapist can be found on Instagram and Twitter and on the web at theradicaltherapist.com and all that, and on YouTube. So look out for that. So that's it for that. So let's get right to the show. This is a very, like I said, a very important, rich conversation with Mark Green. And I hope you please share it widely. I think I just feel strongly about that this conversation needs to be out there far and wide. So if you could share it with somebody you think could really get something out of it. So, but let's get to the conversation. But before I do that, let me tell you a little bit about Mark. Mark Green is an Emmy-winning animator, author, speaker, parent, and senior editor at The Good Men Project. He is the founder of Remaking Manhood, a Facebook community to those interested in manhood, and which I actually am a part of. Joined up just recently. Mark's articles on men's issues have been shared 500,000 times on social media with 20 million page views. He has written and spoken about men's issues at Salon, Shriver Report, Huffington Post, HLN, BBC, and the New York Times. Mark is the author of The Little Me Too Book for Men and Remaking Manhood. And Mark is also co-author, along with Dr. Saliha Bava, of The Relational Book for Parenting. And I'll have links for all of this. But let's get to it. Without further ado, here's Mark. All right. Welcome to The Radical Therapist, Mark.
Good to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. You have a lot going on, so I wanted to... You released an article on your Medium site today that I think is probably getting a lot of attraction. I've seen it shared several places, and also have a new book out. And so I'm really excited to be talking to you, but, you are kind of making, I thought I'm going to start there before we get to the book. I want to start by asking you about this recent, what I feel is a very important article that you posted on Medium this week, titled "Dear APA, I Love You, But the Problem Isn't Traditional Masculinity." And in this piece, you take the position that the APA, in their recent announcement about the problems around traditional masculinity, did themselves no favors in choosing to locate men's issues in traditional masculinity ideology. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that to kind of set the stage.
We have to understand that when we're in the conversation about men and manhood, it is probably one of the most volatile spaces there are. I don't think there's a space that is less prone to lending itself to political arguments and identity binaries and all the other challenges that arise in this space. So whenever a significant player like the APA comes in, I feel like it's really important that we frame where they're coming from in a way that talks about culture and not identity. Because when you go to a population of men, some of whom are very reactive about this issue,
for sure,
and you talk to them from the position of, look, we have a culture of manhood that's causing problems, that's a very different conversation than when you come to them and say, we have a version of masculinity that's causing problems.
Yeah, I like that. Speaking of reactive men, I think this statement by the APA, and also your piece came out at the same time the new Gillette commercial has come out. Mm. And that has many vocal critics claiming that both these efforts are pushing a narrative that seeks to erase traditional masculinity. And I'm wondering how you might respond to these kinds of claims.
Well, I have a tinfoil hat response, but before I get to that one, I would suggest this. We are in a pitched political battle, both in the West and in other parts of the world, for control over resources, access, all the things that politics speaks to.
Sure.
And one of the ways that battle is being fought is men are being invited to be reactive and angry about what's being framed as an attack on men. Mm. Now, I've spent 10 years writing about manhood and masculinity for the Good Men Project. I have another book where I talk a lot about the issues that men face. Mm. But I think the fundamental challenge is that men view their identities as being under attack. And that's not actually the problem they're facing. The problem they're facing is that we live in a culture which strips boys from a very early age of their relational, their natural relational capacities, their ability to connect and express emotionally and do all the things that lead to better relationships. Right. So the actual problem men are facing is that they've been stripped of their relationship capacities and are now in an epidemic of isolation, of social isolation and loneliness. And this leads to anger and rage. And whenever we try to talk about the challenges they're facing, there are certain political dialogues which declare it an attack on traditional manhood.
Yeah, no matter what you're saying, right?
Yeah, and I haven't even gotten to my tinfoil hat part yet.
Do you want to share your tinfoil hat part?
Yeah, I published another article yesterday about the pushback against the Gillette ad.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is there is ample reason to believe that troll farms, the same troll farms which got involved in skewing people's opinions prior to the 2016 and 2018 elections, they're not sitting on their hands between elections. They're getting involved in every single major social or cultural story of the day.
Yeah.
My article's available if you want to go to Medium and look up Mark Green. It's there.
Yeah.
But there's it quotes information from a couple of other sources. There's been research done where literally, and I'm not kidding, and this is the people are like, dude, what are you even saying this for? But there's research that has shown that these troll farms got involved in the debate about the Last Jedi movie. Wow. And they actually drove messages about manhood, masculinity, basically saying that they were ruining Star Wars and emasculating men. Hmm. So there are players in every major cultural debate, and they are driving the narrative that men are being erased.
Yeah, and I have a YouTube channel, and I could tell when the comments are like these weird kind of troll farm type comments.
And they're weirdly uniform.
Yeah,
weirdly
exactly, consistent. Exactly. Yeah. They also
you can see where it's coming from. So I don't want to put too much emphasis on that, but I want people to understand when you get a boatload of dislikes against the Gillette ad, some of that is bot and troll farm driven to the degree that that you can't really trust that stuff.
Agreed. Okay, so you talk about culture, and I think you make a really great distinction in that APA piece. And you write that man box culture is a monolithic and destructive agent, enforcing a narrow and limiting version of manhood, bullying boys and men into lives of dangerous social isolation, like you said. And that man box culture is not a masculinity; it's a cultural agent which acts on us, distorts, and damages our masculinities. Can you say more about that?
Sure. Well, when we talk about traditional masculinity, it is one on a wide spectrum of masculinities. And the problem is not that traditional masculinity exists on that spectrum. The problem is that man-box culture enforces that version of masculinity on the rest of the spectrum. But not only that, we have to come to understand that just like there's a wide range of performances of masculinity within the subset that might be called gay masculinity.
Right.
There's also a wide range of masculinities being performed within the subset called traditional masculinity. And this is the challenge with the idea of traditional masculinity. It's being driven as a political narrative, but when you think about it for a moment, if it is indeed based on what is traditional, well, how many different cultural traditions do we have in the U.S. alone?
Right.
So if men are performing based on their traditional performance of masculinity for, let's say, Jewish culture, Irish culture, Latino culture, whatever, you're already talking about a vast difference in the ranges of performances of, quote, traditional masculinity. So on top of that, if we point to that version of masculinity, which is actually thousands of versions of masculinities, and we suggest, even obliquely, that that one's bad, what we're doing is undermining the very argument for gender diversity. We're saying, yes, gender diversity all the way across the line, except we want to take this whole section and just yank it.
Yeah.
That's why this argument resonates politically. It is not APA's intent to do that, but it can sound like that, and then the political elements push that narrative.
Got it. Okay, and listeners, I'll have links to all these articles that we're talking about on the listener, so you'll have access to them. So, but Mark, you end your Medium piece by writing that the APA's disciplinary gaze makes it difficult for them to locate masculine challenges in our larger culture, which we as men and women create collectively, leaving them no choice but to locate the problem in our individual identities as men. But when we approach the problem from an individualizing perspective, we fall victim to the binaries around identity that some would leverage to keep us from moving forward. And you've talked a little bit about this, but this is so good. I just really like this. I would say it also removes any access to personal agency to take on the man box culture. And I'm wondering if you could say more about the individualizing perspective.
Well, one of the things I write in the opening of my little Me Too book for men is that man-box culture is so dominant that it informs the construction of identity for men. It's so dominant, it's so ubiquitous, it's the air we breathe, it's the water we swim in, to the point where men no longer see the distinction between the culture of manhood and their own identity. And what I'm trying to get us to do is to create a little sliver of light between those two things, personal identity and the culture that tells us who and what we are. Because in that little sliver of air, that little sliver of light, men will find their agency. They will find their own capacity to ask questions about what they've been taught and how they're performing manhood.
Right.
And the APA runs the risk of obscuring that distinction if they locate masculinity problems in identity instead of in culture.
Yeah, that's great and so important. And just for our listeners, maybe, can you kind of define man box culture a little bit? Just, I think we're making an assumption people might understand that a little bit. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about how that came to be and what that is.
Sure. Well, Paul Kibble and the Oakland Men's Project in the 80s began going around to classrooms and talking to boys and girls about what words they would use to define their gender. And boys began, began giving pretty consistent responses, you know, men don't cry, men are tough, men are strong, men are leaders, men don't ever doubt themselves. And this narrative was popping up across all different income levels, class, race. And they began to realize that this definition of manhood was pretty uniform, and that the policing of boys and men to perform this version of manhood was also consistent. If you didn't do manhood right, you were a sissy, you were girly, you were gay. Mm. So a homophobic and anti-female shaming was used to keep boys in this box of performing manhood, which leads to, without a doubt, leads to a bullying, aggressive performance of manhood, leads to boys believing that's the right way to do it, but it also leads to the denigration of women and gays and others inherently.
Yeah,
As we construct manhood, we all feel it, those of us who grew up in man-box culture, we literally have to mindfully push back against the idea that, oh, I'm being feminine.
Absolutely.
I'm being gay. I'm being whatever. I have to toughen up.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about your new book, the Little Me Too Book for Men. And you start this book by writing that it's framed through the lens of one single challenging question. Why is Me Too such a source of alarm for so many men? And I guess I'm wondering, in short, why is Me Too such a source of alarm for so many men?
Well, I would come back to this very clear line between how we police boys and men, starting, I might add, at age 3 and 4.
Right.
Judy Chu wrote a book called When Boys Become Boys, and she embedded herself in a pre-K classroom and watched for 2 years. She was there, followed the same cohort of boys and girls. And she watched this process play out, and she indicates in her book that she saw clear evidence that boys begin to hide their emotional acuity. They begin to hide their interest in a wider range of expression, and they begin to play this version of manhood at a very early age that society sort of demands of them. She tells a very interesting story. She says that a little boy came up to her, a little 4-year-old boy, and he said, "Miss Chu, I'm friends with all the girls, but don't tell the leader of the boys group, because if he finds out, he'll kick me out of the club and I won't have a club."
Wow.
Now, what's interesting about that, it's bad enough that he feels like he shouldn't be connecting with the girls. But what we really want to track in this story, in this moment, is that he's already aware of the pecking order and the hierarchy of his social group and the prohibitions they are putting on him that are anti-female.
Right.
All these things are happening when you're 4 years old.
Yeah, right. Wow.
It's so embedded in us by the time we become adults that you can't help but end up with a culture that is both bullying of other men and abusive toward women. It's just, it's programmed in by this man box culture.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. You also write that Me Too will go down in history as one of the most powerful cultural and political flashpoints in American history. And I guess I'm wondering, what do you think has been the fallout at this point? And what do you think might be built from this moment?
Mm. The fallout has clearly been that those social and political forces who want to maintain the status quo are all in on an attack against Me Too, against the ideas of Me Too.
Yeah.
And the book outlines a lot of the different ways, little arguments that are being made. I mean, we literally have a culture of manhood, a component of which is arguing against the CDC statistics on rape in America, which, by the way, for those who don't know, estimate that about 29 million women in the U.S. are rape survivors, and that doesn't take into account globally what the numbers are.
Right.
But they go against those CDC numbers, and they say those numbers are inflated. Well, my question is, what kind of culture of manhood would be debating how many millions of rapes are taking place instead of how to end it, how to stop this epidemic? So we have to understand that the folks who are fighting against what the Me Too movement is, and by the way, the Me Too movement is had a very simple purpose initially. Tarana Burke started it as a way to acknowledge the number of stories she was hearing from women of color about violence and rape in their community.
Yeah.
Alyssa Milano tweeted out a few years later, "If you have a Me Too story, just retweet this." Her purpose was to show the scale of the problem. That was it. And it worked.
Right.
It worked. Millions of women began to share their stories, their Me Too stories. And the attack against Me Too, if you're going to push back against Me Too, what you're actually pushing back against is women simply saying, "Yes, this happened to me."
Yeah. Wow.
Now, what comes next for Me Too? That is up to the leaders of that movement. And I am very clear to say that I do not speak for Me Too, and I do not speak for women. My inclination is to listen to their stories and to hear how they want to go forward and support them in that.
Mm-hmm.
My book is about why men are where they are on this question.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. And in the book, you state that most men, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, feel that something's off, Something is not right. Daily, we feel a surging dislocation, a weary dissatisfaction, and a restless sense of growing anxiety. And I agree. Can you say more about that?
Sure. The statistical data around loneliness in America and globally is catastrophic. In 2010, the AARP released a study that said that 1 in 3 Americans age 45 and older were chronically lonely.
Wow.
And that's about 42 million Americans. And the only reason they don't have numbers for people below that age is because they're the AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons. Right. So they didn't poll. But when you are chronically lonely, it means you don't have anyone to have a significant conversation with about the issues in your life. And when you are chronically lonely, it has the same health impact as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. It increases the likelihood of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, obesity, depression, everything. So this epidemic of isolation is a byproduct of man-box culture taking basic human relational capacities, gendering them as feminine, and shaming boys for exhibiting them, which in turn takes away from young men the years of trial and error effort that it takes to learn to be in relationship with other people. Every time they try to express a little emotionally, you cry baby, shut up, what are you, a wimp, a baby, a girl?
Mm-hmm.
They never get to do the nuanced work, which is why men's voices sometimes sound so strident and so emotional, because they were their trial and error time to grow how to have these conversations was truncated.
And we'll talk a little bit about that towards the end, but I'm you kind of touched on this, but I'm wondering if you can add more to it. But what has man box culture caused men to lose?
Yeah, man box culture polices men to perform a version of traditional masculinity. And by the way, it is not a rich version of it. It is a caricature of it with a limited set of rules that are meant to be enforced through bullying and violence. So what men have lost is twofold. We have lost our ability to relate, to connect across difference, to collaborate, to co-create, to form community, to form the kind of resilient community that helps us survive in times of economic or health challenges. And that's not just with women. Man-box culture has cost us our brotherhood. It's cost us our connection with men. And as a member of the Mankind Project, I had to go and find a group of men that I could connect and relate to who were willing to make that effort, because most men are afraid of being policed if they seek connection.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
A small price men are paying. Just tiny.
Just
little
a
price.
Tiny one. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. How do you, kind of a question for me, cause I've taken some blowback, and I know you get a bunch of it probably. How do you make sense of the growing angry voices of men's rights groups and et cetera, all of them that are out there? How might one meet these voices?
Well, twofold. One is we have to understand that they have been cut off. If you take a dog and put it in the back of the yard and chain it to a tree and never go out there, that dog is eventually going to go crazy because it is a social animal.
Right.
We are social animals. And when we face levels of isolation, shaming, abuse that men typically deal with when we talk about man-box culture, these men have been stripped of their ability to say, I need help, I need connection, I need love, I need to be part of a group. They're shamed out of even admitting that to themselves. And so all they're left with is this pecking order domination style of communication. And of course, self-reflection is impossible in these moments. So they express the rage of isolation, this being chained up alone, against those individuals around them that they see as being different. And these folks who are in the troll farms and in the political arena are taking that anger and encouraging it. So when you see this level of rage, just write off half of it as being fake accounts posting about this stuff. Right. And the other half is people who have been encouraged by those fake accounts and by the conservative media, sorry, I had to use the word, et cetera, to encourage that anger instead of suggesting connection and self-reflection.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah. You also write in the book about men's silence and the detrimental effects of this silence. And I'm wondering if you could say more about these effects, and can you say something about how men might step out of silence and how men can be more courageous?
Right. Well, I want to just step back for a moment and talk about what this book is. This book is a 75-page long book. It is about a 2.5-hour read. It is intended to get men to see culture, to just stop long enough to look at everything that they have experienced in their own lives, and then think what it is that they truly need or want. Now, culturally, we have a population of men who are strident, angry. I call them alphas and bullies. Yeah. They are the ones who have successfully performed man box manhood to the point where they have some power and they've risen in this hierarchical pecking order, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they're not socially isolated. They are. Think of the most powerful man in the country right now. I would say he is a man box manifestation. I would also say he's terribly isolated.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he keeps acting out in anger and rage and aggression. There's another population of men, and I consider myself to be one among them. I spent my life just trying to stay away from the alphas, trying to avoid them, trying not to be the one that they choose. Hmm. And understand that man-box culture needs targets. There are people internal to that arrangement that get policed, but they also need people externally who they declare simply don't meet the requirements of manhood. And that 10% of the population of boys are brutally bullied, and sometimes to the point of committing suicide or violence. That's required. That's a required part of a hierarchical bullying system. But in the middle is this vast population of men who have learned to just stay off the bullseye, stay out of the way. So they may say to themselves, look, when so-and-so says something at the office about some woman's body, sure, I could get into it with him. I could get into it. We call him Joe the bully in the book. Hmm. But Joe's going to immediately target me. I'm going to have Joe to deal with for the rest of my time at that company because he's never going to forget that I challenged him. Instead, I think I'm just going to look after the women in my family. I'm going to empower my daughters. I'm going to get them into a good school. I'm going to help the women close to me. But the challenge is that these men are silent in the public sphere. We are not speaking up because we know that it may impact our economic status, our social status. It would disrupt what is essentially a relatively safe space that we've managed to engineer, given man box culture was after us every day of our lives when we were kids. Men have to step past that because, honestly, if you think taking care of the women in your social circle, in your workplace, in your home is enough without speaking up, it isn't. Because until we directly challenge aggression against women, the denigration of women, all of that, it will remain an accepted part of masculinity. We literally stand around the water cooler and someone says, wow, nice ass. And we go, yeah, that's part of masculinity. Okay, yeah, I don't like it. Yeah. And so until we directly address that, until all the silent men say, okay, my daughter, my wife, my friends are going to be in danger if all I do is take care of them in quiet ways, I need to start addressing this stuff more publicly. Because the guys who are feeling the pressure of change, of cultural change, the bullies and the alphas are getting louder and more aggressive. And there is no guarantee that this manhood conversation will go the right way if we don't all weigh in. It could go the wrong way. It could go very wrong. Right. And if it does, all of those man box ideas and understand that that angry MRA and man box dialogues on the internet are a recruiting space for white nationalists.
Yeah, right. Yep.
They come into those spaces and they say, hey, you're right, you ought to be angry, and here's some other stuff to be angry about. So this could all go very wrong, and if we let it go wrong because of our silence, then we've got a problem. So men need to realize that we're all in danger of letting this thing get worse.
Yeah, that's powerful, Mark. Thank you for that. Okay, in the book, you have a chapter written in cooperation with couple and family therapist, Dr. Saliha Bava, who's awesome, where you suggest relational practices that men, or anybody really, can take up that can be helpful in creating more supportive and generative conversations around this subject and others like it. And I'm wondering if you can kind of take us through what some of these practices are.
Well, let me say that relational ideas come out of Saliha's expertise as a couple and family therapist.
Yeah.
And that particular school of therapy doesn't locate issues so much in individuals as it does in the family structure, in the social structure, right, in the culture that those people are in. And this dovetails nicely with this question of boys' inherent human relational capacities that are stripped out. Right? We wrongly gender them as feminine, and then we shame boys as being girly, and so boys don't learn how to do this stuff. Well, we have a chapter where we try to help men and women, because if you're a woman married to a man for 25 years and these relational ways of connecting are not taking place, then you're being cheated out of that extra set of capacities as well,
right,
in your relationship. So we're trying to help men and women understand that there are things we can do right now to shift our focus from me and you to us, to the relational, to what gets created in relationship. So one example would be listening with curiosity. And we talk about this idea that even if you've been in a relationship with someone for a long time, or even if you've been working with someone in your workplace for a long time, you can shift to listening with curiosity, because most of us, after 10 years of marriage or whatnot, we think we pretty much know this person we're married to, and we pretty much know more or less how they're going to respond to a question. And often we don't even ask questions or suggest things because we think we already know the answer. And what this does, this predictive idea, I can predict where this conversation is going to go, is that we miss out on the inherent change and evolution of the human beings we're with, right? So if instead we say, I'm going to listen with curiosity to, if my child is upset, if my partner wants to talk about a new idea, if I want to ask a question that I'm not sure the answer will be, I'm going to listen with curiosity. I'm going to set aside the stories I have about that person, the assumptions I would make about them, and I'm going to listen to the conversation in a new way. I'm going to intentionally expect a surprise, something interesting, something new. Because if you just put your hands out in front of you and spread your fingers, every conversation has multiple threads, right? If I'm going into the conversation expecting a certain response, that may be the third finger on my left hand. If that's the only one I'm looking for, that's the only one I'm going to see.
Yeah, right.
But if we look for the smaller threads, the curious statements, the things that we didn't expect, and we say, hey, tell me more about that. What's that part? Or if we go with our child who may be upset about something difficult, and we take this same approach, instead of assuming what went wrong and how to fix it, because men especially, women too, I know, maybe are very uncomfortable when they deal with an emotional response that may be causing us pain, right? So we immediately jump in and say, I'm going to fix this thing. Here's your answer. Here's what you ought to do. And now please don't show me that emotion anymore. Instead, if we say, hey, what's going on here? Talk to me. That child can begin to form their own ideas about this emotional response they're having. And if you check the threads and find the interesting parts, you can help them shift their own ideas about it. Very different outcome, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Outside of curiosity, what would you add to the mix?
Well, we can think in terms of context.
Yeah.
We can think in terms of seeking permission. Often conversations go south because they got launched without a moment of seeking permission. You come home from the office and you say, man, that Bob Johnson, you know what he did today? Instead of coming home and saying, you know, I had a thing at work today. Are you at a place where you could hear it right now?
Yeah.
And just in that moment, they shift a little bit. They go, oh, let me orient toward this. Okay. Or they might say, your partner might say, yeah, listen, I got a thing going on right now. Can we talk about it a little bit later? And in that moment, you get buy-in. Okay, this is going to be a little stressful. This may be a story I've heard before about Bob, et cetera, et cetera. We can seek permission. There's a whole range of capacities, and we talk about these in the relational book for parenting, which is a book that Saliha and I co-wrote. It's full of games and cartoons and stories and fables and articles about all of these different capacities. But we also, I wrote a chapter of it in the little Me Too book for men, because when you do these little exercises, air comes into the room. We suddenly realize, wow, okay, you know, I've been holding my breath for a long time,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Instead, look at this new thing that's happening. Look, I'm seeing something new.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm going to have you both back for the relational parenting book so we can talk about that.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Okay. Mark, thank you very much. This is a very important conversation, and I'm really excited about getting it out there in the world, and so I want to thank you for taking the time to do that. But before we end, I know people are going to be interested in your work and maybe want to contact you. How can folks get the book, and how can they learn more about your work or find you out on the interwebs?
Sure. Well, there's three places they can go. One is... we have a website called Think Play Partners.
Great.
That's Think Play Partners. You can go there and get information about our books and about the partnership that Saliha and I have. You can follow me on Twitter at Remaking Manhood. And there's a fairly vibrant Facebook page. It's facebook.com/remakingmanhood, where a lot of my current articles are and where people are having these conversations.
That's great. And I just joined it as well. So glad to be part of that. Okay. Mark, thanks for taking the time. Like I said, we will have you back. I just want to, this is important work you're doing. And I want to just say personally, thank you as another man. Just thank you for the work that you're doing.
Well, Chris, I'm grateful for you having me here. And we're hoping that we can get more people to engage this book and these and this conversation. We are just a small publishing house, a small little operation, and without the help of folks like you, nobody'd even know about us.
Yeah, my pleasure, and important work. Thanks, Mark.
Okay.
Well, that's our show, and as always, thanks for listening. And like I said, kind of in the intro, please share this episode around with people you think, especially. Maybe some men that are struggling out there with the man box culture. So important. So please spread the word, share it. Be much appreciated. As always, if you want some stickers, some Radical Therapist stickers, please reach out to me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Find us on social media. Come be my friend, et cetera, et cetera. So, Come be part of the community. I got some more announcements coming up, more great content coming up, and you'll be the first to know about it and all of that. So, as always, my name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist, and thanks for listening.